If you look, it's everywhere you look. Young people telling news sites about how they've applied for literally hundreds of jobs with no success. While overall unemployment is running at just over 5%, almost a million 16 to 24-year-olds, 12.8%, are not in employment, education or training. And that includes recent graduates in that age bracket. They're known as NEETs. So what's going on with them? Is it the state of the economy, a lack of skills, or that fifth horseman of the apocalypse, AI? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, to get a picture of the overall employment situation for young people, I'm joined by Xiaowei Xu, Senior Research Economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Xiaowei Xu, can you talk to us about how the overall labour market is doing? And by the way, when you do it, can you just tell us what stats you're using? Because we made a programme not long ago which said that the stats were a bit wonky.
We've seen the labour market cooling in the last couple of years. So straight after the pandemic, there was this real surge in labour market activity. The labour market was really tight, lots of vacancies, lots of hiring. Since then, we've had this increase in geopolitical uncertainty and also trade uncertainty. And as a result, employers have cut back on hiring and we've seen payroll numbers plateau as well. If you look at the number of payrolled employees as a share of the population, that's down about one percentage point in the last 3 years, and it's slightly lower than the pre-pandemic level. Now, you'll see that I deliberately didn't mention any statistics from the Labour Force survey, which is probably the one you did the programme on a while ago. And that's because, in contrast to payroll data, you see employment rates in the Labour Force survey being essentially flat over the last few years.
So essentially, you've been examining a whole series of other statistics which give us a kind of clue. And that's the overall picture. How are young people doing within that?
Young people seem to be faring worse than older adults. So if you look at payrolled employees as a share of the population for young people, that started to fall earlier and has fallen by more. So it's down about 4.5 percentage points from 3 years ago. It's also the same amount lower than pre-pandemic. We've also seen a rise in the share of young people claiming out-of-work benefits. So the share claiming an unemployment benefit or a health-related benefit is around 1.4 percentage points higher than it was 3 years ago.
We've talked about what a NEET is, or reminded the listeners already what it is. These figures are looking at all young people, both those who've been to university and those who haven't, right?
Yes, that's right. So it's actually quite a diverse group. When we talk about 16 to 24-year-old NEETs, we've got 16 and 17-year-olds who really still ought to be in school. You've got recent university graduates and also people who didn't go to university who might have been in the labour force for a while now.
Right, OK. Let's look at these figures historically. Are these figures historically high? Have we seen figures like this before?
They're definitely not unprecedented. So the NEETs rate fell quite a lot in the years after the financial crisis. And the current rate is similar to the rate in 2015 and lower than the rate in the mid-2000s before the financial crisis.
So we were last kind of here in 2015.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's talk about employment now. Is the problem that young people are looking for a job but can't find one, or that some of them, for whatever reason, are just not looking at all?
It's a mix of both. So in the Labour Force survey, the group of NEETs is roughly 40% unemployed and the rest inactive, so not looking for a job at all. If you look at out-of-work benefit claimants, around half are required to search for work.
Now, what proportion of these are graduates?
17% of NEETs in the Labour Force survey are graduates, so that's roughly 160,000 people.
Xiaowei Xu. Now, what about recent graduates? Are they getting jobs? To find out, I'm joined by Jack Kennedy, who's senior economist at Indeed Hiring Lab, a multinational jobs website. Jack Kennedy, let's dig into that one a little bit further. What's going on with graduates?
It's a challenging market for graduates, for sure. And our data shows that graduate jobs, which we identify as job postings on Indeed with graduate in the title, they're down about 20% year on year. They're tracking at the lowest level in at least the last 9 years. It's a tough market because there's significantly fewer jobs than what we've seen in recent years.
How gloomy should we be?
We shouldn't overdo the gloom. I think it's a reflection of the challenging general economic picture. The labour market has been softening, and when we see the labour market slowing down, we do typically tend to see that entry-level hiring is an area that tends to suffer first. We see that employers The first thing they often do is dial back on their new hiring, and also existing workers that have already got a job are less likely to move, which creates less fluidity in the market and less opportunities for young people to come in. So I think it's really a reflection of the uncertainty that we're seeing, but these things tend to be cyclical, so we wouldn't expect it to last indefinitely.
So Jack, are particular sectors affected more than others in terms of graduate hiring?
Yeah, so when we look on a year-on-year basis, we see that certain sectors are down quite sharply. So the human resources sector is down about 60% year-on-year. Marketing and accountancy are also down quite substantially, 52%, 37% respectively.
So why those?
We see that employers have been dialing back on their new hiring in those sectors. They tend to be ones that do tend to be at the forefront of a slowdown. For example, as companies recruit less, they need fewer HR staff to manage that workload. Marketing budgets tend to be cut quite early in the cycle. But we're also actually seeing, interestingly, some evidence of a potential AI-driven shift in the types of roles that employers are hiring for, because we're also actually seeing growth at the same time in some of the sectors adjacent to AI. For example, data and analytics is up quite strongly, about 100% up year on year.
100%?
100%, yes. Scientific research, project management and software development, they're also actually showing year on year growth.
Let's talk about the whole age group for a moment. Entry level jobs. Shall we define a bit more in the general labour market what entry level jobs are and why there's a problem there?
Yes, absolutely. So when we talk about entry-level jobs, we're also talking about all jobs where typically they don't require a lot of prior experience, right? And clearly that encompasses a lot of non-graduate jobs. And traditionally, big entry-level parts of the labour market have been sectors like retail and hospitality. That's often where young people kind of dip their toe into the job market for the first time and gain experience in a work environment in those sectors. But obviously we've been in a phase where the retail and hospitality sectors in the UK in particular have been slowing down quite sharply over the past year, couple of years, and there's fewer opportunities there. So what we're seeing is quite weak picture on the graduate side, but also more broadly in non-graduate jobs, we're also seeing a broader weakness across different types of entry-level jobs in those sectors as well.
Do we know why?
Part of it's been driven by policy. So we had the quite significant rise in employer national insurance contributions. We've had successive quite large increases in the national living wage. We've also had the government's employment rights legislation coming through. So all of that has been reinforcing headwind that's been slowing hiring in those sectors. The cost of employing younger workers in particular has increased. So all of that has kind of had a chilling impact on hiring demand in those sectors. So we have seen that demand for low-wage jobs, and we see this in our data, it's slowed a lot more in the UK than it has in continental Europe, for example. We see that lower-paid job sectors in countries like Germany and France in particular are holding up at much higher levels than what we've seen in the UK.
Jack Kennedy, before we move on, a reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, such as the recent one, which looks at the current state of the UK's armed forces, and the one a couple of weeks ago, which looked at the impact on the energy markets of the war in Iran. Now, back to youth unemployment. I'm joined by Lindsay Judge, who's Research Director at the Resolution Foundation, John Byrne-Murdoch, Chief Data Reporter at the Financial Times, and still with us is Xiaowei Zhu of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Lindsay Judge, can we start with who you think are the group of young people we should be most concerned about?
Well, when it comes to NEETs, we can distinguish between those who are unemployed, so actively looking for work, and those who are inactive. So currently, for whatever reason, they're not looking for work. I think we should first and foremost be really concerned about that group that's inactive. The second point I'd make is that we know that lots of young people who are not in employment, education and training have low levels of qualifications, often GCSE and below. And I think we should be particularly worried about that group. They're a long way from the labour market and unlikely to flourish in the future. And then the third group I'd point to, somewhat counterintuitively perhaps, given that so much of the energy in this debate comes from concern about rising benefit spend, is the large number of young people who are not on benefits but are out of the labour market. And the reason I say that is because that group of young people has no contact with the state and the state has no way of improving their prospects.
So how are they existing?
Well, I mean, the majority of them are likely to be living with their parents or with other family members, and they would be supporting them. But of course, we don't really know what's going on with that group of people. For all we know, they could be actively looking for work. For all we know, they could be holed up in their bedrooms on their Xboxes.
What factors can account for their detachment?
Well, I think one of the most important things we've noticed over time is that the group who are inactive has changed in terms of its composition. So 20 years ago, the number one reason for being inactive, if you were a young person, was that you're at home looking after children. Today, the number one reason is because you have a health condition. And that, of course, puts you at a grave disadvantage. It often means it's had a scarring effect on your education. You've got low levels of qualifications. But it also means that you're a very long way from the labour market.
So what kind of conditions are we talking about maybe that are more than they used to be?
Well, the number one thing, of course, is that we've seen this really quite dramatic rise in the number of young people reporting either a mental health condition or a behavioural condition.
John Byrne Murdoch, what do you see when you look at this group?
Similar things to what Lindsay's been saying there. One of the lenses through which I've looked at this is adding in the factor of whether people are raising their own children. So historically, a significant portion, especially of female NEETs, the reason they were not engaged with the labour market or training or education was they were raising young children. Now, of course, birth rates have been falling, relationship rates have been falling. And so one of the concerning things here is that as well as the growing number and volume of NEETs, we see a growing share of them who are not connected to the next generation either. So the way I talk about it is they're not working, they're not learning, and they're not parenting. So it's that sort of multifaceted isolation disconnection that Lindsay was talking about there. And then there are some other indications as well. So about 60% of NEETs at the moment have never worked.
Never, ever worked.
Never worked at all, never done paid work. And that is a record high. And around 30% cite these long-term health problems. Those, for me, people who've never engaged with the labour market or maybe feel that they can't for health reasons, that feels like an especially long distance from being back in the labour market or the economy, as it were.
Well, I was just wondering, Lindsay, whether there were people, school kids, who essentially lost touch with the school system during the pandemic and who haven't come back into the system through employment.
Well, I think that's a plausible hypothesis. I mean, we certainly know that, you know, obviously a lot of young people kind of fell out of the system during the pandemic. I think what is worrying is that we see that continuing. So we see the rate of school absence still being very high today. So there's, if you like, a kind of backlog or a kind of pipeline of young people that are equally kind of damaged at this point in time, who we're likely to see become NEET in the future without any intervention from the state.
The stat there that really struck me was the share who are absent at least 50% of the time at school. So that used to be 1%, it rose to 3 or 4% in the pandemic and is still around 3%. So those numbers sound small, but you imagine it's 1 in 100 kids. That's now become one kid in every classroom who is essentially just not taking part. And if they're not taking part in school, it's unlikely that they're desperately scrambling for a job, and all of that just creates that pipeline.
And to follow up on John's point as well, I mean, I think the other thing we see is that we see young people presenting with mental health problems much younger, and that's having a massive and scarring effect on their education. So I would really support the view that there's a group of young people who are further away from the labour market than ever before.
Now, let's be absolutely clear here. What we're talking about is kids who actually present with mental health problems while they are at school at a greater level than used to be the case.
Correct.
And the idea that this then knocks on subsequently. Shall we, Shu, is that what you see too?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've seen a big deterioration in mental health among young people. So that preceded the pandemic, but that trend hugely accelerated over the pandemic. And there's some really striking stats from some surveys that suggest that levels of mental ill health among young people are still the same as they were during the pandemic, so during the lockdown years.
What about the benefits system and how that operates on the connection of these young people with the workforce, Lindsay?
When it comes to young people who are unemployed and who are claiming benefits, they are required to look for work. They're required to go to the job centre and talk to their work coach and show that they're actively looking for work in order to receive their benefits. I think the big problem for the group who are in receipt of benefit is the rising number of young people who are on what's called universal credit health. So they're young people who can't look for work at the moment because of a health condition. And there's two things going on there. The first is they receive a higher level of benefits than they would if they were actively looking for work. There's a policy reason for that. But the second reason is that they're not required to do anything in terms of getting what we'd call work ready. And added to that is a kind of breakdown in the system recently in the number of those people who are reassessed on a regular basis. That's to do with lack of funding and to do with problems with backlog from COVID. So again, we've got this large group of people, even when they are in receipt of benefits, who are essentially in limbo, who are essentially kind of languishing.
Shawshu, this is slightly counterintuitive in a way, because I always thought that if you got onto the benefit system, people would be nudging you continuously to get off it and to get into work.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of binary distinction that Lindsay talked about. We have a benefit system that draws a clear distinction between people who are fit to work and not fit to work for health reasons. So either you're required to search for work full time with the threat of sanctions, or you're not required to search for work at all. Now, in principle, the universal credit health journey does include a less severe category where you're meant to be supported by a work coach to prepare for work. In practice, though, very few young people are placed into that group.
A lot of criticism is levelled at the government because of the increase in employer national insurance contribution and the minimum wage increases. And we heard a little bit about that earlier from Jack Kennedy. How much responsibility should these changes take for the changes we've seen in what's happened to youth unemployment?
So I think the two biggest policies here are the rise in youth minimum wages and the rise in employer national insurance contributions. In the autumn 2024 budget, the government raised the rate of employer national insurance contributions and also reduced the earnings threshold at which employers start paying NICs on their employees. Now, that threshold cut meant that it was low-paid workers who saw the biggest increases in employer costs in percentage terms. And of course, we know that young people are more likely to be low-paid and they're more likely to work in low-paying industries. Employers pay NICs on everyone over the age of 21, so it directly affects the group of 21 to 24-year-olds. Under 21s don't attract employer NICs, but more than half of 16 to 21-year-olds work in hospitality and retail industries, which means that they're indirectly affected. Also, minimum wage rates for under 21s went up by 12 to 13% in real terms in 2025, and that's on top of already quite big increases in the previous year.
So the net result is that employers are paying significantly more for young people, and even when they're not, what they're paying for other people will actually have an effect on who they're prepared to employ from the younger age groups.
Exactly. So you're increasing the relative cost of hiring young people relative to older people, and also increasing the overall cost of hiring. And because employers are cutting back on hiring, that's affecting new entrants into the labour market more.
Lindsay, specifically, what about the minimum wage rise?
Well, of course, the Labour government made a manifesto commitment to bring the youth minimum wage into line with the adult rates, and it's powering ahead with that. I think there's a really big question at the moment, when there's so much going on in the youth unemployment space, whether that's something that the government wants to, you know, take a bit of a rain check on. I'm not suggesting that that isn't a desirable objective in the long run, but it might be something they want to take the foot off the pedal for a while.
John Byrne-Murdoch, let's do some international comparisons, because one of the things that's been said is we are now getting the same kind of rates of youth unemployment as other European countries. And I've never been clear whether we measure them in quite the same way. If we look at our youth unemployment as against those of, let's say, European countries, what do we see?
So with youth unemployment, the level has increased significantly, but it is still not as high as what we see in some particularly southern European countries, where it's historically just been far, far, far higher. But it's the direction of travel over the last three or so years where the UK is a really clear outlier. Whether we're comparing against the rest of Europe or the US, we see this steady increase here that we don't really see elsewhere. And then with NEETs, not only have we seen this particularly steep increase, but the UK's NEET rate is now higher than pretty much all of our peer countries. And that includes places like Italy, where historically we've always thought of Italy as a country where the young people really struggle and get left high and dry. The UK is now Italy in that sense.
Okay. Lindsay, why is that?
Two things that we know it's not. It's not that we have less healthy young people at the age of 15. So our rate of poor health at 15 is about the same as many other countries, including some high-performing ones. And it's nothing to do with the fact that our educational performance is worse at the age of 15 either. So essentially, it's something we're doing after the age of 15. And I think there's two things you can point to that are distinctive in the UK. One is that we have very, very poor vocational education. So we know that when young people leave school, whether that's 16, 17 or 18, those who aren't on a university track are bamboozled by the range of options and often a kind of paucity of options too. And the second thing, I think, is to return to our point about the benefit system. Unlike lots of European countries, we do allow this large part of our young people population to kind of languish on benefits for a long period of time. If you look to the high-performing countries, Denmark, Netherlands, they just don't tolerate that. They engage with young people and they don't allow them to kind of sit and kind of waste away.
Lindsay, awkward question. Is this because, do you think, we give so much more attention to graduates than to non-graduates in the way in which we discuss these issues and the way in which policymakers think about them?
Well, I think there's definitely a bias towards talking about graduates because probably everyone sitting around this table is a graduate. I think there's another issue that's sort of structural as well, and this is really important, which is if you want to go on a degree, the funding will be there. It's the Robbins principle, that it's kind of demand-led funding. That just does not apply for further education. So further education has a certain number of funded places every year. And of course, that may not be enough places. So there are lots of further education colleges who are overwhelmed by young people who are not on the university track but would like to improve their education.
And is further education still one of the major ways in which people get their vocational education?
Yeah, absolutely.
John, let's look at that fabled thing that we blame, new thing that we blame for everything, which is artificial intelligence. Have you at the FT looked at the impact that AI is having on jobs?
We look at it pretty much every week, sometimes feels like every day. The evidence on this is, I would say, inconclusive at best. So there are all sorts of ways of slicing the data. The general approach is to say, right, how theoretically exposed are different occupations to AI? And then do we see worse employment trends in those occupations than others? Generally, we see little to no evidence of that. Some very, very fine-grained analyses of particular countries are starting to see that perhaps hiring rates among the youngest people in the most AI-exposed occupations are now worse than the overall economy. But again, I'd say the evidence is fairly mixed. Like the consistent story at the moment is just that it's a very weak hiring market in the UK, in the US, all across the developed world. And when you have weak hiring, that means young people are, by definition, at the sharp end of that.
Lindsay.
So just to add to what John's saying, I think you can look at employer surveys and see what their kind of intent is. And I think what's very interesting is what we're seeing at the moment is employers not saying, I'm replacing people with machines. They're not saying that. But what they're saying is, I'm concerned that I may need to replace people with machines in the future, so I'm holding off on my hiring decision. So it kind of adds to the broader issue that employers always have around uncertainty.
So AI may be acting as a kind of slight drag, just almost by its reputation than anything else.
Correct.
Let's now actually dig into graduates, because although other non-graduates are very important, graduates also have their own importance. Shall I? Are the current labour market difficulties hitting graduates particularly hard, as far as you can tell?
I don't think there is evidence that graduates are being particularly hard hit. I think, you know, the broader picture we need to remember is that low-educated young people are much more likely to be NEETs. NEETs are, by and large, a low-educated group. If you look at NEET rates among graduates versus non-graduates, if you look at 22 to 24-year-olds in the latest data, non-graduates are twice as likely to be NEET as graduates. Now, that's similar to the ratio before the pandemic. And also, if you look at the financial crisis, it was also the case that non-graduates were about twice as likely to be NEET. So it doesn't look like graduates have been disproportionately affected, either in absolute terms or compared to previous downturns.
John, what are you seeing?
Yeah, I completely agree with Xiaowei there. With graduates, I think it's the fact that graduates usually do relatively well. And so this is a real shock to the system. Whereas for non-graduates, it's never great and now it's terrible. And again, when we look at AI and all of this, the impact still consistently seems to be at least as bad, if not worse, for non-graduates. So I think the story here is that it's a very bad time to be a young person entering the labour market, regardless of whether you've got a roll of paper in your hand.
Xiaowei, what policies has the government put in place in order to try and deal with these difficulties?
The government's introduced a number of policies in recent years. In the October 2025 budget, it introduced a youth guarantee where it covers 100% of costs of employing a young person who's been looking for work on universal credit for more than 18 months, for 6 months at the minimum wage. So when it was introduced, it applied to 18 to 21-year-olds. Last week, that was extended to 22 to 24-year-olds as well. And as part of the policies announced last week, there was also a new £3,000 grant to employers hiring a young person who's been on Universal Credit for 6 months or more. So that's a smaller wage subsidy for people with lower unemployment duration. There's also been some policies on apprenticeships, including a £2,000 grant to SMEs taking on a young apprentice, and an introduction of foundation apprenticeships, which are a new type of apprenticeships aimed at young people who perhaps don't have the experience or qualifications for standard apprenticeships.
Lindsay, how do you assess these policies?
Well, I think they're all very welcome, so let's not be churlish about that. And it's certainly good to see the extension of the jobs guarantee to those who are 22 to 24 years old. I think the missing part of the picture is all of the offer from the government at the moment is on the employer side. So they're all about giving incentives or giving subsidies to employers. Very welcome, not knocking it. But what's missing is the support to young people. And again, I hate to come back to it and sound like I'm banging the same drum, but it's these young people who are inactive and who are on the benefits system and who are not being given any support to get work ready. And I think what we need to be looking at, and the government should be looking at in the near future, is what kind of employment activation programs do they want to put in place for those young people?
What are employment activation programs? What would we mean when we say these things? What should the government actually be putting in place?
Well, there's lots of them historically, and actually there's lots of them run by voluntary sector organisations. So they'd be programs that would help people develop a CV, that would help people, you know, prepare to do interviews, would help young people to make links with local employers and the like. So they're very kind of practical. A bit, if you like, it's kind of what a parent might do, actually, for a young person.
Right. Let's imagine something for a moment, which is that I have just been appointed employment minister. And I know this is a very big problem. I've called you each into the room. I haven't got very long at all. And I say, look, so many different things we could do. But the Prime Minister said, I can do one thing to try and help the situation right now, in addition to what we've already proposed. What should I do? John, what should I do?
Look, I feel like I'm stealing this from Lindsay, but it would be around a much clearer message to young people on what is on offer for you at age 16, 17, 18 if you're not going to go to university. Something around apprenticeships that gives people a sense of not just what I'm going to do tomorrow, but where's that going to get me in 5 years?
Lindsay.
Well, let's say John's idea hasn't worked and you've got all these 18-year-olds who still remain kind of bamboozled by their options or lack of options. I would say that we've got to have better second chances at that point in time. And we've got to have a system that thinks...
What are second chances?
Second chances are ways of improving your educational qualifications at that point in time.
Once you've already left.
And or combining that with work. So again, apprenticeships is the model there.
Right, shall we?
I think it would be about trying to target young people before they become NEET. So there's lots and lots of data we can use to identify who's at risk of being NEET. We can think about bringing work coaches into schools to try to target these people specifically.
And that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Lindsay Judge, Xiaowei Shu, John Burr Murdoch and Jack Kennedy. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Nathan Gower and Kirsty Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was James Beard. And the editor was Richard Varden. And another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I'm Jamie Bartlett. And for BBC Radio 4, I'll be looking at how fakery took over the world.
No, hang on, sorry.
You're not Jamie Bartlett. I'm Jamie Bartlett.
Oh, really? Well, who am I then?
I'm afraid you're not real, pal. You're just an imitation chatbot I created to help me make this series on modern fakery and why it's everywhere.
Sounds good. What's going to be in it?
Well, there's a lot. 1980s professional wrestling, dodgy academics, AI psychosis, COVID vaccine skeptics.
What's it called?
Everything is fake and nobody cares. With me, Jamie Bartlett.
And me, Jimmy Bartlett.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.